that today's cosmological model, at least the concordance one, is lambda CDM. And only 5% of our universe is made up of stuff that we really completely understand. The rest of it is dark matter, makes up about a quarter, and dark energy the rest. Now, we have really not that many cosmological probes that are capable of making precise inference about the nature of dark matter. So this figure shows the equation of state of dark energy, versus omega matter. So if you take the lambda CDM, the cosmological constant, that predicts that, W should be minus one. But because our probes are not desperately precise, there's quite a lot of leeway for the equation of state to deviate away from one. And the only way we can really get down to, precise measurements, this is this orangey yellow one, is to combine data sets. And if you start doing that, then it really matters about the systematics in individual ones. If this green banana is offset, if this is slightly due to a systematic error, then this orangey yellow one will be offset too. You can get more data by adding things like priors on the Hubble constant, the expansion rate of the universe today. So this figure shows how useful H-naught measurements are at lifting the degeneracies in the CMB. But there's a problem with H-naught, and that's that the low redshift measurements, things like the using supernovae as standard candles, give higher values of H-naught than what you get if you take the CMB measurement and assume lambda CDM and propagate that down to an expansion rate today. Now, that assumption of lambda CDM might be wrong. So these arrows up here show you how much the Planck measurement changes for Hubble constant today if you deviate away from lambda CDM. So let's say you add an extra species of neutrinos, you end up with a Hubble constant that's well consistent with the low redshift measurements. But alternatively, it might just be that some of these measurements are plain wrong. So how do we ever tell the difference between a systematic, a mistake, or new physics? Well, I would argue that the most compelling reason we believe in dark energy is not because any one probe says that the omega lambda is not zero. It's because we have multiple probes that all cross over in the same region of the parameter space. So you can imagine that if there were systematics in each of these, they would move off in random directions, and the chances of them crossing in exactly the same place becomes very small. But to do that, to do this test to check they all mutually agree, you need lots of probes. And this is where strong lensing comes in. It's an alternative way of measuring cosmological parameters. So this is what strong lenses look like if you haven't seen pictures. And you can imagine strong lensing is a bit like an optical bench. If I were able to slide my source back to higher redshift, then the Einstein radius gets bigger. So you know straight away that the images are going to where you see the images is going to depend on distances and hence on cosmology. But also you could imagine swapping out your lens for one with a higher refractive index. Again, you change the path that the light goes on and you make the Einstein radius bigger. So there is a degeneracy between the lensing mass and the angular diameter distances. So you want to get at angular diameter distances because they depend on interesting things, W, omega matter, H naught. But you need to be able to either lift this to either learn something about the mass or add new information. And so I'm going to talk about systems in which you have more information. So these are systems that either have a time variable source or where you have multiple background. I don't know how well you can see this on this projector, but there's a second blue arc system outside the first white one here. And so you've got two sources at different redshifts feeling the same lensing mass. So first, the time delays. Why is this useful? Well, you imagine if you have a source that flashes just once. You can see, just looking at the paths on this, they're not the same distance. So the one that's going down this path, you're going to see that flash arrive faster just because of the finite speed of light. So this one comes slower. But we also know from general relativity that things in deep potential wells, the clocks run slower. This path also gets further delayed by the Shapiro delay. So the net result, those two things go in the same direction. This image ends up arriving later. And those time delays are proportional to what we call the time delay distance, which is a ratio of angular diameter distances. And for the value of the cosmological parameters in our universe, it happens that this is basically most sensitive to the Hubble constant and much less sensitive to the other cosmological parameters. So this, you've probably all seen this before, the way that we measure the Hubble constant normally. You measure parallaxes for some things nearby, then you use those parallaxes to calibrate how fast Cepheid variables are pulsing as a function of their luminosity. Then you go to supernovae and see how far away they are based on their standard candliness. But this is a right pain in the ass because it's every single one of those steps potentially can have systematic errors. And so if you make you get issues somewhere along the way, then you end up with a systematically biased measurement of the Hubble constant. So strong lensing's nice because it's just this one-step measurement. It's also nice because we don't have to assume anything about the lens being standardizable. It doesn't matter if we live in a weird part of the universe. If we live in a local void, that won't affect the value of H0 that we infer. And it's neat because it's a really cheap experiment to do. You don't have to give me, $100 million to go out, build a new telescope, survey all the redshifts of everything in the universe. So it's pretty cool. So the obstacles to actually make a measurement with these time delay systems. Well, the first thing you have to do is actually measure the time variability of the quasar and measure the offsets. And that's not as trivial as it sounds because the quasars aren't varying very much. You have coverage gaps in your light curves. This is where the thing goes too near the sun to observe. So if the time delays are ever about 6 months, then forget it. The sun gets in the way. You have events like this one. So you see, if this were purely based on the time delays, these light curves would all look self-similar. But what's this weird peak here? That's a microlensing event. That's a case where in the lens galaxy, there are stars, and one of the stars has just gone past right over the top of one of the lensed images, so it causes a little bit of flaring up. And so you have to be able to take that out of the light curves. But if you can do that, and you can, then you can measure time delays pretty well. And the easiest way to do it is when the quasar just suddenly makes a sharp change. You see that here. There's this sharp variation, and you see it in the other light curves about a month later in these two. And whilst that one's noisier, that one comes 77 days after the first one. So measuring time delays is now relatively easy, and the Cosmogrel team in Switzerland have been monitoring of order 20 lenses for the best part of a decade now, and they're able to measure all the time delays with sort of three-day precision. Lots of different independent and blind methods all giving very similar results. So this is pretty much a solved problem. The next hard problem to get out of, to get cosmology from time delays, is that if you remember I told you the time delays were proportional to this time delay distance, what's the constant of proportionality? Well, it turns out that that's a function both of the geometry, the extra path difference, and the potential. So we have to know something about the mass distribution in the lens. So this is the full equation written down. This term tells you the difference in path length, and this term is just talking about the difference in potential. What it means in practice that we have to learn about is, if you imagine you have two images like this, if you draw circles centered on the lens, the thing we really need to know about is how much mass is in that annulus. So if you just see two images, how can you learn about how much mass is in that annulus, right? You want to fit some density profile for the lens that is sensible falling off in some way that you don't really know. You need to find the centroid of the dark matter halo. you need to solve for the positions of the unlined source that you don't know. And you realize all of a sudden, just looking at two images, that's just not enough data to solve all of those all of those parameters. However, when you have a quadruply imaged quasar, obviously you've got four lots of positions, and you've got three independent time delays, so you've got a lot more data. But the holy grail is when you can see the host galaxy of the AGN. So this is the galaxy that the quasar lives in. And you can see here in this one, you can see it's going to be just by eye something a bit like the Milky Way. You've got this orangey-red bulge of old stars and these blue star-forming regions around it. So when you think about this, this all comes from one source, but yet you've got multiple images of all the different bits of the source. So there's only a very finite range of mass models that can actually fit this data and give you an astrophysically sensible, consistent source. So that allows you to really constrain the density profile very well. What we do in practice, you take your data, you fiat some lens model, so you shoot a ray at all the pixels, ray trace back onto the source plane, and that lets you build a big matrix that says your data is that matrix times the value of the source pixels. You sample over all the parameters of your model and see what you get. So this is the best model for this for the lens I've been showing you. You can see we get qualitatively the right results. It looks right. And when you marginalize over or sample over the cosmological parameters, we find that we can make inference on the time delay distance. So that's what this is here. And it's you can see it's degenerate with some of the other, well, not degenerate, but covariant with some of the other parameters. So this one is talking about the density profile of the lens. So unsurprisingly, because that changes how much mass is in that annulus, that's quite strongly covariant with the time delay. And this is what the source looks like when we invert it. And it's kind of hard to see on this, but it's like a bright central bulge, an extended region with some star-forming knots. So,
if you have multiple bands here, so you're showing black.
This is just a single band reconstruction.
But you show the color picture.
Yes. Obviously, you can use color, but we haven't for this one.
What are the different colors in the likelihoods?
So that's to do with a systematic test we did where. So this source is broken up into many different pixels, and we found that the number of pixels that we chose has a slight variation in the cosmological parameters that you infer. So we just marginalized over all the different pixel values. They don't coherently move. It's not like they go from fewer pixels to more. They just seem to jump around and.
Fifth, it doesn't include the different colors.
But yeah, this is.
Isn't that a lot of information?
Yes, it adds more information. But it's also a harder computational problem to like.
Just because achromatic display would be a lot of information.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might just sort of reverse thing, check the covering parameters of the lens model or. Consistent
with the different bands. Yeah, we've done that. They are, but actually doing a simultaneous fit to all three, because you could just do it three independent times, but really there's, if this central region is very bright in the red, but completely absent in the blue, that would be strange. So really we push that off, the whole multi-chromatic stuff off till we have a better scheme for dealing with regularization across colors. However, we haven't quite measured cosmology at this point. We've measured the time delay distance, but that was all done assuming that the lens lives in an otherwise homogeneous universe. That is, of course, a terrible approximation. We know the universe is clumpy. And it turns out that when we look at our lenses, put them in a context of their lines of sight. The first lens that we were modeling, this one is, it lives, well, all of these dots show galaxies that, that have an R-band magnitude brighter than 23. There are twice as many dots in that central circle as there would be if I picked a random line of sight. So it turns out that that's extremely rare, that you have lines of sight with that many galaxies along them. And if you do a spectroscopic analysis of this line of sight, you find that there are basically four groups in a row. That's also very rare. So this, the approximation that this line of sight is homogeneous is wrong, but also the approximation that this line of sight is in any way normal is also wrong. This line of sight is also weird, but in a slightly less extreme way. And this is a problem, because in strong lensing, if you put down a sheet of mass, just a uniform mass sheet, you can rescale the lens and rescale the source in such a way that none of the observables will change apart from the time delays. So if you do everything assuming that there is no effective sheet of mass, and then infer the Hubble constant, if there was a sheet of mass or something that looks like a sheet of mass, say the outskirts of halos or a negative mass going through voids, then you get H naught wrong. So if there's excess mass on the line of sight, you overestimate the Hubble constant, and if it's underdense, you underestimate the Hubble constant.
So are you thinking that the cumulative effect of all the mass in the universe that's not gravitationally bound to the lens, is that what
you're saying? Yeah, so all the stuff along the line of sight, because it's halos and most of it's far away, okay. Apart from the stuff that's very close, you can approximate it as just sheets of mass and shearing terms.
Could you try to use weak lensing to get a handle on that?
You can, but the scales are very different. And so this sheet of mass, or the effects, they can be on a few arcsecond scales, because that's the size of the Einstein ring, but the weak lensing only gives you meaningful information on arc minute scales and above. So all of the small scale power, the weak lensing can't really help you with that.
But if you fit a profile as a group or a cluster, you can get some sort of typical.
You can.
NFW baseline is almost constant. Right?
Yeah, so I spent a whole year of my PhD trying to do that, and pinning down the mass of that halo based on any feasible observation that you can get for lots of galaxies in the field is really hard. So you might say, well, if there's more stellar mass, more, or even more photons coming, then I can write down a bigger halo. But that relationship is very fuzzy, and I don't want to talk about that year again. It didn't work. So what we tend to do is we tend to calibrate against simulations. We go to the simulations that have we paint galaxies on using a semi-analytic model. This is quite an uncertain process. So the way we pick lines of sight to calibrate against, remember how I said that the line of sight for this lens had twice as many galaxies as a normal line of sight? We look at the lines of sight in the Millennium simulation that have the same relative overdensity. And you see that, so for two doubly overdense, this is the PDF for the external convergence, the mass sheet. And it's something like an 8 or 10% shift in the value of H naught that we would have inferred if we hadn't done this. So for this lens, we do all that. We've measured the time delays, we've done the modeling, and we've learned about the line of sight. We measure H naught to be 70 plus or minus 5. Exactly what you would expect from all the other measurements, which is lovely.
So is the error dominated by the uncertainty in kappa?
So for this lens, it's this width of this PDF makes up the majority of the error. The modeling uncertainty and the time delays are not insignificant, but between them they only make up about a third of the error.
How is it that, the way you described it, it sounded like the factor the topology on the gravitational lensing observables was only through this one number in the distance ratio. So how is it that you get two numbers that are unconstrained
So we used a CMB prior to measure. Is that, do you mean how are we measuring W and H naught?
Oh, I see. Seem
WMAP
5 alone
would
consume one combination of
H. Yeah. Yeah. But really, it's so blue is our constraints without using a WMAP prior, just using uniform for all that. And you see, it's this vertical blue band. We're really just measuring H naught. We did the same thing again for 1131, this lens. This time we wanted to make sure that we didn't, not that we cheated the first time around, but we wanted to do it blindly to convince you guys that we're not pulling all of this out of thin air. So we did that. This is what we saw. We unblinded, turned it into a time delay distance. And we got an H naught of 79 plus or minus 5. A little bit high, although it's important to stress that that's only a 2 sigma outlier from what the CMB measurements would tell you. So you expect these sort of uncertainties to, these sort of events to crop up 1 in 20 times. So it's.
That's the 1 sigma error.
Yeah.
Did you say anything
else
the difference between
the analyses? The only difference is that. Meaningful difference is this one's blind and it's a different lens.
It's a different lens.
So you expect them to give different.
But again, here you took the mean number of galaxies along the left side or something and corrected based on simulations.
Yeah. So that's a little bit high, but perhaps not so high to be too concerning. But we went and investigated a little bit the systematics. So Schneider and Sluse in 2013, they wrote this paper that said, well, the model you choose for the lens could bias the value of H naught that you extract. So they showed, so typically we model lenses as power law density profiles, and they found that if you instead model it as a Hunkvist profile for the stars and then add it to an NFW dark matter profile, that could change your value of H naught by quite a lot. Most of their models are not astrophysically physical, so we didn't expect it to be that big a change. But regardless, we went back, fitted the lens instead of with a power law with this composite profile, and we found that it made, so blue is the composite profile, and pink is the power law one. It makes a small change at the order of 1% or so, but it goes in the wrong way. So that didn't help. And it doesn't seem to be a big issue what profile we choose. Looking back to the line of sight, it's very hard to do much better than the number counts calibrated against simulations. And we do expect our lenses to live on weird lines of sight. So this is the distribution from the Millennium simulation of kappa, the external convergence, versus gamma, the external shear. You can see they're strongly correlated. So if you live on a line of sight that has a lot of shear, then you expect to live on a line of sight that also has a lot of kappa. Now we know, since we're looking at quadruply imaged quasars, that there is a significant shear bias in our sample. So these are the causticks. This is basically on the source plane. So if your source falls out here, you get one image. If it falls here, you get two. And if it's in this central asteroid, you get four images. And this is what happens as you increase the shear. So you see this asteroid gets bigger. So there is a strong bias towards living in higher shear lines of sight if you're picking quads. Also, by adding a mass sheet, you make the Einstein radius slightly bigger than you would if it weren't there. So if your selection function is very close to the resolution limit of your telescope, then maybe that little bit of extra kappa can push you over from an undetectable lens to a detectable one. So we expect the lines of sight to be somewhat weird. So I had a summer student do this last year. We simulated all the population of lenses, assessed which ones were detectable or not, and then built a PDF for kappa. And we find that the net shift for the quadruply imaged quasars is only 0.009, so a 0.9% shift on H naught. So this sort of effect, when averaged over many lenses, should go away. Right now, with only two systems, it's pretty hard to do any kind of jackknife systematics kind of tests. But we have three more systems in the can. Five more have been approved for HST imaging, and we have a few that we've got adaptive optics images for. So we're very close to being able to really understand these systematics better. This lens, if you'd invited me in, I think, 3 weeks' time, we would have unblinded this one. But you can see we're able to model this. This is the residuals for this lens. These are our systematics tests. So we know we've got another lens, and we've made something like a 7% measurement of H0 from this one. So stay tuned. So that's the time delay lenses. That's a somewhat mature field for measuring cosmology from strong lensing. Much more exciting, in my opinion, are these double source plane lenses. Two sources, one lens, different redshifts. Of course, this is very rare. How often do you get a strongly lensed source? Like one in 1,000 maybe or so. How often are you going to get another source behind that? It's not quite as rare again, because you're biased towards having a massive object already on the line of sight, but it's still pretty unlikely. Sure.
So back, I seem to have the impression, maybe it's wrong, but that back in the early days of doing this technique with Kachanik's group, that they were, I forget which way it was, but they were maybe getting quite a bit lower or quite a bit higher than the current. Which way was it? Were they getting higher or lower?
They were quite a lot lower.
They were getting down like 50, something like that. And what's the main thing?
The first wave of problems was people not being able to measure time delays. So if you only monitor for a year, you tend to do that you tend to get very bad time delay estimates, and they were systematically underestimating their uncertainties. The next wave of problems was people assuming density profiles that were much too simple. Back then they were, typically they were just assuming isothermal profiles. So that was basically the root of the big change. The line of sight stuff is not important at the level of the big 50 versus 70. It's only really important if you want to start doing cosmography at the few percent level.
Another question on that. So you mentioned that there were two effects that went the same way, the greater path length and the larger Shapiro delay. Mm-hmm. Am I right? Is the Shapiro delay negligible, or is it actually?
No, they're about the same size.
About the same size.
So for an isothermal distribution, they're the same size.
So the Shapiro. Oh. Somehow on the back of the envelope, it sounded like the Shapiro delay was hours or something like that at most. I don't think so. We can play around.
Yeah. So these lenses. These are cool because they give you two Einstein radii, one mass. So you can imagine taking the ratio of those Einstein radii, and you can measure cosmology. In practice, what you really want to measure is the ratio of these two lines. So you have a single fixed deflection angle, a physical deflection angle at any point in the lens plane. You just trace it back onto the two different source planes. That ratio of angular diameter distances is this. It's the product of the red ones divided by the product of the blue ones. And if you can measure that, it's cool, because since all angular diameter distances go as 1 over h, the h0 dependence divides out. So we can learn something about W, omega matter, without having to resolve any of this tension in the value of the Hubble constant. It's also cool because it's much easier than those time delays, because you don't have to measure the time delays. And a lot of the line of sight stuff that I was telling you about divides away. So these systems are rare, but they do exist, right up from galaxy scales like this one, through groups, up to the most massive clusters in the universe. This system actually has more than 30 known background sources. And the reason for this is that the cross-section for strong lensing scales very rapidly with mass. The Einstein radius goes as mass squared, so the chances of having progressively more sources in that within that lensing cone, 2 goes as m to the 4, 3 would go as m to the 6. So galaxy scale ones rare, cluster scale ones very common. you can hope to do this with clusters. Gillot et al. Had a go back in 2010 to measure these ratios of Einstein radii. But the problem is that these clusters are complicated. So you've got of order 100 images in here, but how many clumps of mass do you see in there? All of those need modeling, right? So unless you're going to make some very hard assumptions about how mass follows light and the profiles of that mass, you're going to spend all of your information from the images learning about how mass is distributed in clusters. Now, that might be an interesting problem to you, but it's not going to teach you about cosmology. This lens, on the other hand, it's an individual galaxy. You can see just looking at the light profile, it's much simpler. You can probably describe that with far fewer parameters. Now, you might want to shout at me here and say, but dark matter simulations, they're all clumpy, right? You get subhalos. Well, it turns out that the key feature of this is that these arcs are big. They fill a large part of the image plane. So the small clumps, they just shuffle things around a very small amount. You can detect that effect. In fact, Vegetti et al. In this system found a dark matter substructure about 10 to the 10 solar masses in this arc. Now, that's not in my analysis. It doesn't bias the cosmology at all. I checked because it's too small. But that's just an indication of how sensitive these lenses are to measure perturbations. So, double source plane lens modeling, same as the single ones, except you have to trace back onto two different sources. Don't forget that this source has some mass, so it will perturb the ray as it passes through. So your matrix now has two sources that you've got to solve for, two separate smoothings that you have to fit for each one. And again, we can MCMC optimize and see what fits. So this is my model for that lens. The normalized residual, you see it's very close to Gaussian random noise. There's a slight underprediction here. That's the 10 to the 10 solar mass dark matter subhalo. And this image is slightly underfit, and that's where this source goes through this source plane here. So I assumed that this source is an isothermal sphere, because it's small, it's only a perturbing effect. But you can see looking at it, that actually assuming it's a spheroid is a little bit naive. So it's not too surprising that the image that gets closest to it is slightly misfit. So these are what the sources look like, sort of typical strong lensing sources. There's a strong bias in lensing towards small objects because they're more easily magnified. So that means you tend to get these high surface brightness, clumpy star-forming galaxies. Now, I'm not very interested in what the best fit model of anything is. I'm interested in the uncertainties. So what happens when we MCMC? Can we make meaningfully interesting inference? And the answer to that question is yes. So we measure things like the density profile slope of the lens. So this lens is pretty close to isothermal. We measure the Einstein radius of the first source. So this is it. To put that into context, we've measured the lensing effect of a small galaxy, a galaxy with a velocity dispersion of 100 kilometers per second at redshift 0.6. So this is the, as far as I'm aware, the lowest mass field galaxy ever to be weighed by strong lensing. But the thing I suspect we're all most excited about, we've measured this beta parameter, the ratio of angular diameter distances, 1.404 plus or minus about 1%. So what does that mean for cosmology? Well, if you're only excited about lambda CDM and measuring the parameters of it, it's quite boring. So there's only one free parameter left in lambda CDM, and that's omega matter. And this is a PDF. We can sort of say that omega matter's probably not one, but not with any overwhelming confidence. So no Nobel Prize for me, I suspect. However, if we're interested in more interesting cosmologies, say we want to probe the equation of state, then we have this interesting degeneracy, and we can very strongly rule out these universes that have very low omega matter and very negative equations of state. Turns out that's where the CMB puts an awful lot of its probability density. So gray is the Planck constraints. And if you add just this one strong lensing system to the Planck constraints, you get the black ring. You do about 50% better than you did with Planck alone. And interestingly, you remove some of that tension. The Planck on itself is not very consistent with minus one. But
can I ask, are you using a uniform pi or a one
this analysis? And did you investigate any other possibilities for prime?
I'm using a uniform prior on beta. So strong lensing is this angular phenomenon. And so except for time delays, none of it requires you to know anything about redshifts or cosmology at all. It's just this one parameter that includes all the cosmology. And then you use that to sample cosmological parameters.
Are you saying that there's an implied prior on W that's induced by a prior on beta? I'm just imagining it's in an MCMC chain that your W is being drawn uniformly in the range that you plotted on the graph.
Yeah.
So, but because the constraints are relatively weak within that space, especially if you have priors at the edge, one might imagine the results could be quite sensitive to how you choose the prior.
Yeah,
so uniform is not well motivated.
Yeah. So on this figure, it is a uniform prior that's been drawn both for W and for omega matter. But yes, I take your point. Here, effectively, we're using Planck as the prior.
Okay, thanks.
Planck uses a uniform prior on W as well.
I mean, you have to use something, of course.
That's pretty cool. Precise measurement of W with just one lens. I'll overplot that over the constraints from the other probes, and you can see it's bang on the money. It's comparably precise. And yet you've probably not heard about this before. But you probably have heard a lot about weak lensing. And the thing I like to point out about this measurement, this is the CFHT measurement with the same prior for the equation state of dark energy. This is where weak lensing is at, and this is where the double source plane lenses are at. So with just one double source plane lens, we beat a few hundred square degrees of weak lensing. Now, the problem is, of course, that with weak lensing, you can build a bigger satellite, put it in space, or build a big telescope, put it in space, and ramp this up to crazy good precision. Whereas with the double source plane lenses, you have to go out and actually find some more. That's hard, but it turns out that those weak lensing experiments are perfect for finding strong lenses as well. So I've done some forecasting. Basically, we know the population of elliptical galaxies in the universe from SDSS. We know the population of sources in the universe from surveys like Cosmos. And so if you put down mass on these ellipticals, trace back their deflection angles, you can simulate strong lenses. Working out how detectable they are is slightly hard. So what you do is you have your idealized lenses that have come from those populations, put them through the a mock observation by whatever your favorite telescope is. And I guess that hasn't come out very well, but you can see an arc in this one. And you can do that for loads of telescopes. So this is what this simulated lens would look like in CFHT, DES, LSST, or Euclid. And you can see it's very clear. It's very obviously a lens in Euclid. DES and LSST, not so much in the final co-ads, but if you're clever and just take the best seeing exposures, so with a ground-based telescope, the image quality depends on the atmosphere. Atmosphere changes, so sometimes you get rubbish data and sometimes you get good data. If you take the good data, then this becomes a really obvious lens. We calibrated the model. Well, actually, no, this was not designed to happen. The model, we checked it against an existing survey that they'd looked for loads of lenses using a method that's basically you take blue images, subtract off the same image, but the red band, because the sources are blue and the lenses are red, look at the residuals and see what you find. Our model predicts exactly the right number, which was pretty cool. So we're confident that this is a good way of making predictions for future strong lensing populations as well. Dark energy survey can find between 800 and 2400 systems, depending on how much better we can do in terms of the lens finding methods. LSST 60 to 120,000, and Euclid up to 170,000 new strong lenses. So we're talking three orders of magnitude improvement in sample size. Euclid gets a zero for current technology because it's only got the one visible band, so doing blue minus red will be hard. But we can also simulate the double source plane population. It's pretty easy. Put two sources down, just change the relative weights. And we find that between DES and HSC, Hyper Supreme Cam, a Japanese survey, we expect to find of order 10 double source plane lenses in the next five or so years. I add these together because I'm in DES, but HSC is much better. They have a much much better resolution, and they showed me last week a new double source plane lens that they'd found. So our sample has now gone from one to two, which is pretty exciting. But where things really start to ramp up is with these really big weak lensing surveys. Euclid can find literally hundreds, 650 double source plane lenses. LSST, just looking in the best single exposure, not doing any kind of, not really exploiting the full depth of the survey, can find 120. I cheated a little bit with these Euclid ones because I've only shown you the prettiest. But even ones that look this obvious, you still expect to see 65 in the Euclid data set. And that's enough lenses to start saying interesting things about perhaps evolution in the equation of state, so this WA model. One lens is boring. 100 lenses measured to the same precision gives you these red constraints. Figure of merit of 40 without assuming flatness, but these numbers, they probably don't mean anything to you. So I'll just put up the Euclid weak lensing most optimistic forecasts. So comparable precision. Yeah, Euclid's a little bit better. But hey, they spent hundreds of millions of euros. And as I said at the beginning, the important thing is to have independent measurements so that you can actually trust the results coming out from probes. So that's my spiel about constraining dark energy with strong lenses. Yeah, so it's going to be expensive. Actually, the lens I showed you, the second source only has a photometric redshift, but it's an HST one. So again, that's quite expensive to go out and get many, many bands of HST imaging. This number of 100 is partly motivated by the fact that we won't be able to follow up all of the lenses. So I showed you several hundreds coming from LSST and Euclid. Yes, that will be hard work, getting a lot of redshifts, velocity dispersions for the deflectors, but it's not unachievable. The SLAC survey looked at of order 100 single plane lenses. They got all the HST data for that. So it's an achievable follow-up program. So now I'm going to deviate away from talking about dark energy. This one's come out terrible. Can I turn the lights down? Is that? No, it's all sunlight. Okay. Well,
no
worries. I'll use my last 10 minutes to talk about dark matter instead. So this is a cluster we found in DES. It's you can see maybe little red fuzzy blobs. They're the cluster members at redshift 1. And then you see this blue arc system around here. Really hasn't come out very well, but the Einstein radius of the system is 14 arc seconds, which is much bigger scale than the galaxy system, the galaxy scale lenses I was showing you before. And what that means is the total mass in this system within the Einstein ring is about 10 to the 14 solar masses. So we're really talking about a cluster here. It's sufficiently massive that it shows up in the SPT Sanyavs-Obdovich cluster catalog. And their M500, it's a bit noisy because it's only just massive enough to be detectable. Their estimate for M500 is 2 times 10 to the 14 solar masses, but measuring out a significantly larger radius. So this is quite a consistent picture. We're talking about a real 10 to the 14 solar mass cluster at redshift 1. Now, you all know that if you run a cosmological dark matter simulation and you look at the density profiles of the halos, they follow a universal profile that's well approximated by an NFW. So that's density going as 1 over r in the center and 1 over r cubed at larger distances. However, we don't live in a universe that only contains dark matter. We live in a universe that contains baryons as well. And they make this simple NFW picture quite a lot more complicated. You have cooling processes that act to move things in towards the central regions of the halo, dragging the dark matter with it, causing them to steepen. And that's what this dashed line shows from these simulations by Martesi. But you also have processes that dump energy into the baryons, causing the halo to puff up and become more cored. So if you have AGN, active galactic nuclei, doing feedback and dumping some of their energy into the baryons, you can produce cores in the dark matter. Another way you can produce cores in dark matter is if the dark matter itself is not CDM, but is self-interacting. So this is simulations by Rocher et al. With self-interactions turned on, halo sensory densities decrease, forming cored profiles. And you can see that black is their cold dark matter, and green and blue are different degrees of self-interaction. And you can see the density profiles flatten off. Now this lens, because it has a bright central image, that's this region here, I don't know how well you can see it. There's this blue feature. It's the same color, and it's the fifth image of this background source. So it's, if you imagine you have a source here, the rings do this, and we're the... Okay. Probably still can't see it, though, can you? So this is the image that comes right through the middle of the cluster. So normally, you never see images that come right through the middle because they get destroyed because they're demagnified. You imagine if you got a slightly different angle through the density profile, you end up deviating quite a lot because there's an awful lot of mass in there. So the fact that we see this image at all tells us that the density profile must be quite shallow in the center. So this is what happens if you put a source behind an isothermal sphere. No central image. As you make it shallower, a central image starts to slowly crop up. An NFW profile predicts a faint central image. But if you look at the size of it relative to the size of the arc, you can still see it's still quite demagnified. The size of that image is much much smaller than the arc is wide. With this system, I'll skip through to here. You can see this is the G-band data. The size of this feature is comparable to the width of the arc. So you know that the demagnification or that it's not significantly demagnified. And even at the dodgy seeing that is DES, this is genuinely resolved. We know straight away that this profile is quite shallow. So I tried fitting it with a power law profile. We're well within the region where you expect the NFW halo to turn over. From 1 over r cubed to 1 over r. So your naive expectation is that the density profile is just going to go as 1 over r. I fit a power law, and I can do a great job for the arcs with a profile that goes as 1 over r to the 0.7, but rubbish for the central image. You're not seeing it at all. Okay, so it's not power law. Let's fit it with an NFW halo, but we'll give it an extra degree of freedom. We'll allow the central density profile slope to vary. That's what this alpha parameter is. But again, it's rubbish. We get a little bit of flux in the center, but this image has run off outside of what I'm showing you. So that's no good. So let's instead just forget about what we know from dark matter simulations and fit it with a broken power law where the inner slope is free and we'll call that alpha. The outer slope is free. We'll call that beta. We have some break radius RC. Also, in all of these models, we include a little bit of, we allow for flattening of the halo. And we include the baryons, the galaxies themselves, as clumps that we fit for as well. What we find is that this broken power law model can reconstruct the data really well. So data model looks right. Look at the residuals, it looks really right. The most significant residual is this bit, which is actually me doing a bad job of subtracting off the AGN that lives in the BCG of the cluster. And this is what the source looks like. Again, who cares? What's interesting is uncertainties. And this is what we get. So this is the inner slope. This is the central density profile of this halo. And we find one would be the NFW prediction, but we find at 95% confidence that it's got to be less than 0.33. So very strong evidence that the central region of this halo is cored or at most a very shallow cusp, a big deviation from what the dark matter only predictions are. And the scale that this is, the break radius, for a pure core, it's at least 35 kiloparsecs, and it gets bigger as you increase the inner slope. So what we're seeing is that either we've got a huge core or an even larger shallow cusp. Both of these represent huge deviations from what the NFW would have predicted. So you either have to turn on a lot of of self-interaction for the dark matter, or an awful lot of AGN feedback, a lot of energy being dumped. These results are, whilst very exciting, they're also consistent with what other probes see at lower redshifts. So this is a recent result using M87, basically our nearest, a very massive galaxy, to probe the dark matter profile of the halo. See, black is the circular velocities for NFW, and orange is their constraints. It's not consistent with NFW, but they can't tell the difference between a cored, whether the halo has a core or just a shallow profile. Similar things at redshift 0.2, using kinematics of the stars plus multiple imaging, strong lensing and weak lensing, and again, black is an NFW slope, blue is what they're seeing for the dark matter. In both of these analyses, there's a BCG living right at the center of the halo, so the dominant uncertainties in these analyses is subtracting off the baryonic component, and that's what makes these measurements hard. The neat thing about this halo is that the BCG is slightly offset from where we see the image, so none of this relies on subtracting off the baryonic component. The downside, of course, is that how often do we expect BCGs to be offset from the central density from the centroid of the dark matter halo? And that's a poorly understood question. So this halo could potentially be weird. It might potentially be merging, although it is extremely surprising that you can reconstruct this whole arc with such great precision, with a profile that is so simple, and actually it comes out as almost perfectly spherical, if this is some kind of merger like the Bullet Cluster or something like that, because it just shouldn't look like a spheroid if it's merging.
The offset is how big relative to 15 kiloparsecs?
It's about 15 kiloparsecs, the offset.
The offset is not equal?
Well, it's less than half the core radius. So, of course, when you have a core, the sinking time scale for the BCG to go to the center is longer as well. So it may not be that weird that the BCG hasn't sunk.
But the centroid is a free parameter in your
lens? Yeah, the centroid of the dark matter is free. And the centroid is where the image forms, which is what you would expect.
You might worry that, so if I understand the constraint, you're saying the core can't be cusped, because if the line of sight went through a big cusp, then it would be demagnified and you would not see the...
Yeah, you wouldn't see it at all.
We might worry if for some reason you don't understand the BCG is not at the geometric center of the halo. Maybe there's a cusp, but it's also just not at the geometric center.
So the...
I mean, I don't really have an explanation.
Yeah, so if you did put a cusp over where the BCG is, then that would introduce a lot of asymmetry to the model, so that you would not expect the model to come back spherical again. So you have to balance it out with a cusp on the other side, and it starts to get very, so it's the fact that the fit is so good with such a simple model is extremely surprising. If, like, yeah, you can come up with all these ways of breaking it. I think it's much more likely, if you don't want to, if you want to be cynical about this, it's much more likely that the model itself is right, but the interpretation is somehow wrong. That actually, maybe it's a merger that's perfectly along the line of sight, and so it still looks. I mean, that also seems pretty forced. But these cores are what you see in dark matter interactions. Sorry, in self-interacting dark matter models, and they're also what you see in models with extreme AGN feedback. This is a simulation with some of the most feedback, and even with a halo that's 10 times more massive, their core radius is about 10 kiloparsecs. So you expect the radius to get bigger with mass. We're less massive, but see a bigger core. So whatever is going on in this system, it's certainly weird.
How big is the mass of the BCG relative to the mass of the core?
The mass of the baryons is a free parameter, and the BCG doesn't have much mass at all. I haven't worked out the exact relative amount, but the dark matter is dominant.
The dark matter, if you compare the BCG, I guess it probably has its own galactic halo. If you compare that to the core.
So typically, when you model these things, the BCGs don't get their own halos, right? The halo of the BCG is the whole cluster. It's only, you only give halos to.
I guess I'm just thinking if the BCG is in its own dark matter halo, but I mean presumably it is. I mean, and it's sloshing around at a radius of 50.
Yeah, it's going to churn up the dark matter.
Unless it's very small, very, very small relative to the mass of the halo, it wouldn't be very unexpected if that was then smoothed out to that scale.
So that's the take on how you measure dark matter with strong lenses. I have got a few slides about compound lensing, but I'll skip through this. This is the idea that if you put mass in the first source of a double source plane lens, you can get some really, this is sort of the illustration. You have paths that go through the middle and zigzag. And so that leads to loads of images. You get some really high magnifications. So this is a great cosmic telescope if you're interested in high redshift galaxies. Extreme magnifications are not rare. So this is magnification by a factor of 100. And we see that something like one source in 10 to the 8 in the sky is magnified by that much. 1 in 10 to the 8 sounds like not very many, but actually that's the sort of numbers of sources that these big LSST Euclid are expecting to see. And that's without putting magnification bias in. There's a lot more sources that are fainter than their detection limits, and these are the ones that you get boosted in. You can get up to 16 images of a background quasar with just two masses along the line of sight. So that's a lot more information to constrain your mass models. 16 images never happens, to all intents and purposes, in a real universe. But 8 image systems are comparably common to the magnification by a factor of 100. If you want to talk to me about that, then I'm happy to, but I'll wrap up here. No, we just don't. We don't have big enough data sets at the moment. But we should do with Euclid and LSST. The most magnified, the highest multiplicity is a 7 system, but that's coming from a very complicated cluster mass distribution rather than two simple masses along the line of sight. So that's my summary. Strong lensing provides powerful and complementary constraints on the dark universe. Precise measurements of the equation of state of dark energy. Interesting measurements on the halo profiles of clusters. We expect in the future to see hundreds of useful, cosmologically useful lenses and hundreds of thousands of other strong lenses. And this is quite hard. So we need a lot more work to do still to beat these down to get it to interesting precisions. But I've shown you all the dirty laundry, and that's what we as a community will be working on for the next 10 years. Thank you.
So how on earth did you find that cluster lens?
Oh,
that's what you showed us.
So that's easy because it's an SZ cluster. So you know that massive objects have are more likely to be lenses. So the first thing you do when you get your new data is you go, where are the clusters? Oh, that's weird. It's got a central image. That's how we found that one.
Aside from LSST, are there any other prospects for following up thousands of time delay lenses?
So we have we bought a load of time on the ESA 2.0, the MacPac 2.2 meter telescope, which will allow us to follow up 40 lenses, and that's cost us several hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you want to scale it up to thousands, then you're going to need several hundred million, well, yeah, you're going to need several millions of dollars to do that. But LSST monitors the whole sky every four or so nights. So LSST is the way to go rather than turning on your mind.
Just out of curiosity, how are the lens systems found in the first place?
It's a right hodgepodge. So this one, looking at clusters. This one, if I can get back to it, is serendipity effectively. So the first source was found using the redshift. So SCSS does a redshift survey. You see, and they target all the massive elliptical galaxies because they're good traces of the BAO peak and the large scale structure. But you see the emission lines from this galaxy in that same spectrum, and that they're at the wrong redshift, right, to the BCG. So you go, you look at them with HST, so that you can do your lensing science. And lo and behold, this one just happens to have another source. And the team that found that, they did some back of the envelope calculations. They say that actually should happen for about 1 in 40 lenses for lenses of this mass. And I did some less back of the envelope calculations that roughly agree with that. It's about 1%. Other lenses that you find, looking purely at the morphology of the arcs. So you do some subtraction and you go, oh, well, that looks a bit lens-like. You can also find lenses if you have a very steep luminosity function that looks like this, and then you see sources out here, they've got to be these guys that have been magnified. So it's a real inhomogeneous sample of how you find lenses.
So what's your lens model? How many parameters do you have?
So the lens model is, have this slide. Had too many slides to get through, didn't I? So this is the lens model. So there is a parallel or ellipsoid for the primary lens, an isothermal sphere for the second lens, and an external shear term. So there's six free parameters in here, one free parameter for the second lens, because I fixed the centroid of that halo to be where the bright peaks in the image trace back to. So I've insisted that the mass follows the light distribution. And then two free parameters for this. So there's nine model parameters and one cosmology parameter.
Yeah. And when you're trying to do precision cosmology, I mean, don't you have to still somehow demonstrate that simple models are okay for this beta ratio compared to all the realistic complexities?
Yeah, so that's work in progress. Fitting more complicated models. Fitting more complicated models to the time delays didn't seem to make any difference. So I'm pretty confident this will prove to be fairly accurate. We also know from surveys that combine dynamics with Einstein radii that the total density profile is consistent with these power laws. So more work needs to be done to make sure that the systematics in this measurement are not too large. But this model is consistent with what we know about elliptic.
Might not be also good to take simulations and focus on individual galaxies, take the very good thing.
Simulations are much too difficult because of simulating the baryonic physics. And so when you we tried to simulate some lenses in
no, I'm not saying that it's simulated lenses. I'm saying so people who simulate galaxy formation and claim that they get a lot of things roughly correct and with feedback and take one of their galaxies and treat it as a lens and use these models. Like
we retraced through those and. They look like power laws, but I don't trust them because I don't think the baryonic physics in the simulations is good enough to be convinced. So it's consistent with the simulations, but I wouldn't call that overwhelmingly good evidence.
What about the cosmic variance in the just material between the two sources?
Yeah, so that using the Millennium simulation, I calculated the effect. It's about 0.7 sigma, and that's not included. So you can blur up the uncertainties by a little bit more for that.
I'm not really worried about magnification bias, though.
Not the magnification bias for this, because it's an extended object, it's much harder to get extreme magnifications anyway than it would be from a point source. And we're inferring the properties of the lens anyway, so you infer what the magnification is. So you shouldn't, the magnification bias shouldn't give you a bias on cosmology.
Wasn't it more likely that you would detect or notice the Schrödinger lens system if there was a big magnification effect?
Yeah, it is, but extreme magnifications are very rare. So it's to get a lot of mass along the line of sight is in many objects is much harder than to get all the mass in one object, statistically speaking.
How is that consistent with your statement that the convergence along the cosmic variance of the convergence along the line of sight affects the answer? If you're more likely relative to that width of the distribution, you're more likely to be in one half of the distribution or the other.
The point is that the effect of the external convergence, it's sort of, if you have a 0.1 external convergence, that makes the Einstein radius 10% bigger. And 0.1 convergence is almost never exists in the universe. So a couple of percent change on the Einstein radius is very unlikely to push you over that threshold from undetectability to detectability. So that was what I was showing earlier, the time delay lenses, is that bias exists there, and it's very small. But for these, most of that is coming from the fact that you're making it easier to make quads. This isn't selected on it being a quad, so you expect the bias to be much, much smaller.
Okay. Right, it's been found.